WNYC is supported by Austria, home to a 900-year-old monastery where a biomass furnace provides green energy. That's Austria, old and new. Learn more at experienceaustria.com.
Hi, this is Leonard Lopate. You're listening to WNYC On Demand. Podcasts, streaming, and MP3 downloads available when you want to listen at WNYC.org and iTunes.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
Over the past two decades, depression rates in the United States have risen considerably, and sales of antidepressants have skyrocketed. Psychotherapist Gary Greenberg argues that in most cases, sadness has been manufactured into this epidemic and that sorrow has been confused with a biochemical imbalance. His new book, Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease, is published by Simon & Schuster. I'm very pleased to welcome him to our show. Hi.
Hello.
And I'm sure you're aware of the fact that you're going to get a lot of people angry with this book.
Well, that wasn't the purpose, but I've heard that's going to happen.
Why do you say that depression was invented, not discovered?
Because that's what happened. Because there came a point at which it became convenient and profitable for the medical industry to think of unhappiness as an illness.
So how would you explain the condition that's generally diagnosed as clinical depression? Just unhappiness, sadness?
I think we don't really have the answer to that question. I think there must be cases in which depression arises without respect to what's actually happening to people in their lives. But I think most of the time, it is the result of our interaction with the environment, our transactions with the universe, as one psychiatrist put it.
It's triggered by some sad event in a person's life.
Yes, and I think that, as somebody said to me last night, sometimes the real mystery is why more of us aren't depressed.
Well, what about those people who are completely immobilized, can't get out of bed, can't carry on the basic functions of life? Are they just being sad, or are they suffering from some kind of biochemical condition? Because often when they take medications, they can get out of bed.
That's right. And I think that the fact is that from the beginning of record keeping, which is maybe 2,500 years, since people have been describing this condition, there are people who, without respect to what's actually going on with them, can't get out of bed, can't function. And that condition takes the appearance of a disease, which currently we think of as a biochemical illness. But we still don't even know in that case whether or not it fits that category.
Well, in the case of manic depression or bipolar illness, according to the latest jargon, hasn't lithium been quite effective over many years? Graham Greene said he was totally incapable of working until he took lithium, and then he wrote some pretty famous books.
That's right, and I think that you have to remember that just because a drug improves your condition, that doesn't mean you had a disease in the first place.
So are you arguing that this is more a matter of ideology than of real medical condition, similar to the people who argue that alcoholism and drug addiction aren't a form of illness?
Yes, along those lines. I mean, I would say that a real medical condition is not as straightforward as we want it to be. Just because we believe now that a real medical condition is a form of suffering that has a biochemical pathogen behind it, that's a relatively new definition of disease, and I'm not sure that it really covers even the physical suffering that we have.
Do you see other mental problems as perhaps being biochemical, schizophrenia, for example?
I think that, it's like with manic depression or the severe depressions you were talking about before. They have the appearance of that kind of a disease, and it wouldn't surprise me if at some point we actually targeted what was going on with people like that. But at this point, it's speculation.
So you're saying that that perhaps depression is never caused by chemical imbalance?
No, I'm not saying that. I'm saying that there are probably cases in which it is, and that in all cases of any experience, any kind of consciousness that we have, there are biochemical events that contribute to it. The question, we could even say cause it. The question is whether or not that's where the problem arises, or the best place to look to for why we feel the way we do.
There are people who I've read that say that depression exists in people with low serotonin.
Yeah,
you're saying that that's never been proven?
I'm saying that it's not been proven as the case in all cases of what we call depression. There are various biochemical tests for various kinds of depression, but even those don't show anything like 100% correlation.
There is often a what came first, the chicken or the egg problem in situations like this. We could have low serotonin levels that cause us to be depressed, or we could be depressed and that could cause low serotonin levels.
Yes, that could be whatever the biochemical thing that's going on is, could be the way that our brain produces the depression. And I think that the chicken and egg problem is almost impossible to escape. The question is, where are you going to intervene? One of the reasons that this question even becomes important is because recently, in the last 20 years or so, the question of where to intervene has been answered increasingly by we intervene at the molecular level.
My guest is Gary Greenberg, who's written a book called Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. Well, isn't it in your best interest as a psychotherapist to dismiss a biochemical explanation for depression? Before the medications were developed, wasn't the talking cure the main way that depressed people were treated?
There's no question that it would be in my interests, although I have to say that the interests aren't really that opposed to each other. There are plenty of people who are taking drugs and going to psychotherapy, and in some cases the two go together quite nicely. I'd also add, in my own defense, that there are many other ways for people to, that I know of, that people can handle their depression, ranging from things like exercise to changing the whole structure of their lives to make whatever it is that's bothering them no longer a problem.
Although I knew somebody who was depressed who started exercising, didn't see immediate results, became more depressed. But I've always wondered about the talking cure because it didn't strike me as being all that effective in many cases, and that's perhaps one of the reasons that people turn to medications.
I'm sure that's true. I'm also sure that when it comes to measuring the effects of talk therapy on depression, there's plenty of studies that show that various forms of talk therapy work as well as the drugs.
When did depression start being talked about as a biochemical concept?
This started to emerge in the 1950s, and the reason that it did was because people were taking drugs, often for other purposes, that just accidentally made them feel better.
The first one I remember is Miltown.
Miltown.
An antidepressant. I don't know what Miltown is.
Miltown,
is it still around?
In a slightly modified form, I believe the brand name now is Soma, and which Aldous Huxley would appreciate. Miltown is a tranquilizer. And at the beginning of the 1960s, Miltown, Valium, and Librium were the treatments of choice for if you were going to give medication for depression. At around that time, some new drugs had come along, again, accidentally discovered. One was called imipramine. The other was called amitriptyline or Elavil. And their makers really wanted to displace some of the Librium-Valium market. And the way that they did that was they started a campaign to convince doctors that depression was a biochemical illness. And at that time, particularly given the state of our knowledge of how the brain works, this was really highly speculative. But it fit the idea that we had of what a disease was. If you could claim that something had a biochemical cause, then you had the opportunity as doctors to say, okay, and I have the cure.
Before the 1950s, what did people in the field think that the root of depression was?
Well, before the 1950s, people in the field weren't as likely to see depression as to call the kind of unhappiness that we now call depression by that name because the treatments were extreme. They were insulin shock, they were electroshock therapies, and those weren't the kinds of treatments you'd want to give people who weren't severely mentally ill.
Is this something that's happened in this country alone, or people in France or Germany or Argentina or wherever as likely to be treated with medications for depression these days?
Well, there's an interesting case study of this exact phenomenon in Japan, a book that just recently came out called Crazy Like Us, in which we can see depression being sold, not the antidepressants, but the disease itself being sold in Japan. And in my book, what I do is I show how that happened in this country. So yes, it's happening everywhere, but it's happening for the same reason.
You're saying that the Japanese are now being sold on the idea that depression is a biochemical matter?
Yes, in the last 15 years.
What have they thought it was before?
Well, that's something that I don't remember the exact details of that.
Because the Japanese don't rely on talk therapy.
No, they don't. And it may, as I recall, it was considered just much more the way things had to be. And it was sold there by creating the impression that a depression was a serious but common medical illness. And so the antidepressant market followed along. The disease has to come first, and then the drugs come.
But even for people who believe in the efficacy of the drugs, and there are many, the side effects can be a major concern. Weight gain, dry mouth, sleep deprivation, short-term memory loss. There have been claims of increased rates of suicide.
Yeah, well, and the most important side effect, I think, or at least the most common side effect, is impairment of your sex life, which a surprising number of people are willing to put up with in order to take the drugs. And I think this is a really important point. The drugs do something.
And what do they do, and well, why do they seem to work for many people if this is not a biochemical situation?
Well, because you're tweaking your serotonin metabolism and other things, other neurotransmitter systems in your brain. And when you do that, you change the nature of your experience. So it's not really a mystery that they should affect the way people experience their lives. But we don't really know very well what they actually do, because there has been very little interest in figuring out the answer to that question. In some ways, you've probably seen recently the news reports that depression, that the antidepressants don't really work. In some ways, that's because we've been looking to see whether or not they relieve depression defined in a very narrow way. And so the tests and what the drugs do don't line up very well. So to answer the question of what is Prozac consciousness, we'd have to ask a whole different set of questions of the people taking the drug. And there's not very much interest in doing that, because by and large what you'll come to, I believe, is that the drugs change people's personalities.
A listener writes in that his depression arises from a brain injury. He was hit by a car when he was on his bicycle, and the circumstances of his life aren't causing him to be depressed, but the brain trauma is.
There's a really interesting case study in the New England Journal of Medicine about a woman being treated for Parkinson's disease with what's called deep brain stimulation, inserting electrodes deep into the brain and stimulating them. And they turned on the machine, and she immediately, within 90 seconds, became suicidally depressed. She started to weep. She said that life wasn't worth living. There's no question. There's got to be a circuitry in the brain, probably many more than one, that can do this. And unfortunately for this fellow, his got switched on that way. That doesn't mean that this is always what happens.
But could we argue that something sad happens? We lose a loved one, or something traumatic happens in our lives, and then that switch gets switched on?
Triggered? I think that's the current model. The switch gets switched on, and then it gets stuck. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, you sort of wear a groove
in your
brain.
Some people get past it, and others can't get past it because the switch has been turned on.
That's right. And then that is considered a matter of bad luck.
And you're saying that's not true?
I don't know whether it's true. I'm saying that I don't think it's as obvious that it's as true as the medical industry wants to say it is.
Gary Greenberg is my guest. He is a practicing psychotherapist and the author of now two books. This is your second?
Yes.
This one is called Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. It's published by Simon & Schuster. We will continue our conversation after we take a little break. By the way, we invite your comments on our show page at WNYC.org. We're back with Gary Greenberg, whose latest book is called Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. It is published by Simon & Schuster. Weren't you diagnosed with major depression?
I was.
When did that start?
I've been, in retrospect, probably a depressive all of my life by the diagnostic criteria.
So, and yet you wouldn't say that that was, would suggest that there was something biochemical or genetic?
I should say my adult life. I think the first time I really became aware of it was when I was in my middle 20s.
Were you already working as a psychotherapist?
I had just started, yeah.
And, well, I know that people who go through that kind of training see every possible illness in themselves. So I suspect that you wondered whether you were depressive.
Actually, I didn't, because that was in 1986, and it was before it really became the fashion to think of the kind of suffering I was experiencing. I mean, I had just had a marriage blow up and some other setbacks, and at that time, it wasn't quite so common to think of yourself as ill if what you were was unhappy. It was like, at that time, I figured it was the equivalent of whacking my thumb with a hammer really hard, and so it hurt.
So it was not all that common to be diagnosed as being depressed.
That's right.
You say the explosion occurred when?
In the last 20 years, not coincidentally, contemporaneously with the rise of the new generation of antidepressants.
Well, not all doctors who treat this can even prescribe drugs.
That's correct. Only medical doctors, except in a couple of states, can prescribe the drugs. And not all the doctors, most of the doctors who prescribe the drugs aren't psychiatrists. Most of them are primary care docs like OBGYNs or family doctors.
How is depression diagnosed? There is a book that kind of defines it, isn't there?
Well, the official diagnosis has to be rendered with a test called the SCID, which is tied to the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual. Most of the depression diagnoses are being rendered with very quick paper and pencil tests given in doctor's offices or not at all.
Well, if a patient came in to your office, said, "Doctor, I'm really depressed," would you do the SCID test?
Would I know? The SCID test is takes at least 45 minutes to do. Very few clinicians do that. It's mostly used for research.
And what would you, how would you proceed with somebody who said he was depressed?
I would proceed by talking with them about how he experiences his depression and what he thinks it's about and where it might come from and what we can do about it, which could include referring him to a doctor to take drugs.
You say that when doctors diagnose patients with depression, they're making a philosophical or a moral statement.
I think that's true of almost any diagnosis. I just don't think we notice it very much until the diagnosis has something to do with our consciousness. I mean, anything that you call an illness, we're basically saying it's not a good thing.
So when you were diagnosed as having deep depression, were antidepressants recommended?
Well, I got my diagnosis in the context of participating in a clinical trial. I had wanted to be in a clinical trial for something called minor depression, which I thought I and many other people had because it only requires two of the nine symptoms of major depression. But when I took the SCID, I turned out to have, according to the doctors, major depression. And the clinical trial was a trial of omega-3 fatty acids. So I took that as the trial medication.
So the fatty acids, we might call that a placebo, mightn't we?
Well, I don't think that people who are looking at it that way, looking at it scientifically, want to think of it as a placebo. I think they want to see it as having a specific effect at the molecular level.
Well, I take fish oil pills in the morning. They're pretty much the only pills supplement I take. Am I staving off depression?
You could be, according to this theory anyway.
Did it make you feel better?
In the course of my trial, I improved on the scales that measure depression.
Although there's always been an argument that if we just let something sit, it might very well improve all by itself. In fact, that was a criticism often of talking therapy.
That's right, and nobody really knows. I should point out that in the trial I participated in, I was on a placebo. I wasn't on the fish oil.
Hmm. You didn't know that, or when did you find that out?
I found that out at the end of the trial when I sent a couple of capsules into a lab and had them analyzed, and they were regular vegetable oil, it was a trial that had a placebo arm in it. I was just in the placebo arm. What was interesting about it is that my doctors were convinced that because my numbers had improved, I must be on the drug.
Well, a placebo effect, it works strongest with the mental, emotional areas, doesn't it?
Yeah, with pain
it's harder for a placebo to cure cancer.
We see very few placebos curing cancer. That's right.
So maybe we shouldn't be surprised. Or as I said, it could have simply been that the time is also a cure.
That's correct.
A listener called in to say that he and his wife broke up 5 months ago and he's really depressed. He wakes up crying but isn't taking anything because if you want to experience great love, you also conversely need to experience deep pain. You shouldn't avoid it. A lot of great poetry wouldn't have been written without people experiencing pain. It sounds to me like this man is putting himself through an unnecessary trial.
I think that's a deeply philosophical question. How much pain should one expose oneself to when there is relief available? This guy's obviously making the choice because he still thinks it's valuable to experience the pain. It's a free country, and people can and should be encouraged to think about that possibility.
Another listener wants to know about your scientific method. What kind of research are you basing your arguments on?
Historical. My research is entirely historical. I started to look at where did this idea of depression come from, and I was surprised, actually, to discover that there's a very traceable history of how the idea was assembled, starting in about the middle 19th century with the development of magic bullet medicine, the idea that you could find a drug, target a molecular a target, and kill the disease. Starting there and working right up until the present day, unhappiness was increasingly put into the category of the kinds of suffering that could be treated that way.
But the other side of this argument can be that that the old way, many lives were lost, were perfectly and valuable people spent their lives moldering in a room because they just couldn't work themselves up to do anything.
I think it's really important to point out that there's nothing that I say in my book that says that people shouldn't take these drugs or other possible drugs to make themselves feel better. What's really important is how you understand your drug taking. Are you taking the drug because you want to improve the quality of your life to make yourself feel better, or are you taking the drug to treat a disease? And I argue in the book that that's an enormous difference, because if you think of yourself as treating a disease, you won't necessarily think about what else might be going on that figures into your unhappiness. So this is not an either-or question. This is a question of what does drug taking mean? It's also important to point out that drugs, especially consciousness-altering drugs, change their effects according to what you expect them to do. So if you tell somebody, I'm giving you this drug to cure you or to treat your biochemical imbalance, they will experience it that way.
Although I knew somebody who was seriously bipolar and needed constant adjustment for the medications because he would be regulated for a period of time and then suddenly he would fall apart.
I would say that up until very recently, the bipolar diagnosis was a much cleaner category than unipolar, or what we call major depression. Recently, the bipolar diagnosis has started to do the same thing, and we can see over the last 10 years with the development of certain drugs that bipolar has become an alternate description for moody, which it wasn't until about 10 years ago.
Well, what you're saying is that there are real conditions, but then we expand them to cover all sorts of things. It's the same sort of thing that we're seeing with hyperactive kids. There are kids who are seriously hyperactive, and then there are kids who just have a lot of energy who we might very well label ADHD.
That's correct. I think that what happens is that the idea that our suffering can be captured this way and treated this way is so appealing at so many levels. I mean, we're really complicated people, creatures, you know, people are. And to all of a sudden say, wow, this really complex form of suffering that I'm doing, it all comes down to a little bit of a chemical imbalance and I can fix it with this drug. That is such a hard solution to resist.
My guest is Gary Greenberg, who is a practicing psychotherapist. He's written about the intersection of science, politics, and ethics for many publications, including Harper's, The New Yorker, Wired, Discover, Rolling Stone, Mother Jones. His latest book is called Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. It's published by Simon & Schuster. This is WNYC, WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. The U.S. government was paying for the research that you participated in, that clinical trial. You say they're compliant in the antidepressant industry.
The government?
Yeah.
Well, the government is complicit only insofar as they regulate the drug industry. And the Food and Drug Administration, in a wise decision back in the early 1960s, decided to make drug makers prove that their drugs actually worked. Up until then, they didn't have to prove that. And when they did that, they created an incentive for pharmaceutical companies to specify the diseases that their drugs work for. And that, in turn, has led to what some people, although not me, call disease mongering. And what happens is that there becomes a premium on calling more and more of our suffering a medical disease if you have the cure for it. And there's some ridiculous examples that I think we're all familiar with, depression not being one of them.
A listener wants to know what you think of mood lifters like SHTP.
Well, without getting into the particulars, all of these drugs could be termed mood lifters. In fact, that was one of the original names for them back in the 1950s, because that's what happened. Antidepressants were discovered when a drug called imipramine was given to schizophrenics, and it agitated them. And doctors looked at it and said, wow, if it agitates schizophrenics, which, by the way, is with schizophrenics is not a good thing, what would it do to people who are depressed? And so they gave it to people who were depressed, and it lifted their moods. And so they have this, that's what they do. They lift and they stabilize your mood, sort of like.
There was an article in the New York Times Magazine earlier this year that dealt with what was called the westernization of mental illness, about how we're spreading our ideas about mental illness in the same way that we're exporting McDonald's and Starbucks. Are you talking about something like that here?
Yes, and it's not the problem. I mean, that's the same book. That's the export. The problem is that it's local. It's domestic. It's been done here, and the model works here.
Well, to some degree, it's because Americans also believe, along with our Declaration of Independence, that the pursuit of happiness is an inalienable right. And, yeah. And isn't it?
Yes, it is. What happens is that when we when our pursuit of happiness runs into roadblocks, it becomes very difficult for us to understand that. And one of the things that we have to be able to do is to figure out what's in the way. To say that what's in the way is a biochemical imbalance, on the one hand, gives us a great answer. Well, that's easy. We just take a pill. But there are material conditions of suffering that also stand in our way, and that I think we tend to look at less when we think that our inability to pursue happiness is the result of some kind of disease.
A number of our listeners have been upset by what you've been saying. How have people in general received your views on depression?
I guess I only talk to my friends about it.
You must have depressed friends. You have people in the psychology field
I think most of the trouble comes because people think I'm trying to say that there's something wrong with taking drugs. And I think that if you read my book, it's really clear that I'm not saying that.
But you're saying that we should understand why we are being prescribed drugs. In some cases, it might not be a good idea, but in other cases, maybe the only way.
I'm saying that in some cases, it might be a good idea to think that the drugs are relieving a biochemical problem, but I would believe that in most cases, it would be better to think of the drugs as helping you get by.
Well, there are people who will stop taking their medications and then they sink back into their depressions.
That's right. And sometimes that's because perhaps they had some kind of biochemical imbalance. But in many cases, when you talk to those people, what you find out is they really liked the way they felt when they were taking the drugs. And so when they start to feel the old way again, they don't like it anymore.
Well, you're saying that there is some similarity between this and the use of recreational drugs?
I am saying that. It's not the same thing. There are many important differences. But especially when it comes to marketing these drugs, the drug industry has had to steer a huge wide berth around that question. That's why we don't know what Prozac does to people, because if we did know, we'd have to talk about things like the changing of personality, which is much closer to what recreational drugs do than what we normally think of therapeutic drugs doing.
I wonder what would have happened if Timothy Leary had been given placebos instead of real LSD.
I really don't know. Unfortunately, he's not alive anymore, so we can't ask him that question.
But the placebo effect does work. There was, in fact, an article in the New York Times about that as well, a cover story in last January that found that some widely prescribed drugs for depression were no more effective than a placebo.
Again, I think that's a measurement problem. Mm-hmm. I really believe that what's happened there is that the drug industry, in its zeal to make depression seem like a disease, chose a test that would give a better appearance of depression being a disease, but they chose a test which does not show what their drugs do very well. And they were able to bury the fact that the placebo comes out as well as the drugs only shows you that the test is working. It doesn't show you that the placebos are what's doing the job. We have not yet measured what these drugs actually do.
One more thing. A listener wants a clarification. Are you saying, this listener asks, that taking drugs alone without addressing other issues won't solve anything?
No, I think it could. This is what drives my publicist crazy. The answer to this.
You want to give nuanced answers.
I want to give an answer that's complicated. Sometimes, yeah, I think that's a problem. Other times, no. I mean, I don't have anything against people taking a drug, feeling better, and getting on with their lives. What I really have a problem with is 15 or 20 or 30 million people walking around thinking they're mentally ill, which automatically changes the way you look at the world.
And also, you're suggesting that certain drugs have been marketed, that there's, that the pharmaceutical industry, which is always seen as a villain anyway, has cashed in on something by creating a condition that may not really exist in many people?
That's right, or at least encourage people to think of their suffering in a certain way. And frankly, I'm not that much of an enemy of the pharmaceutical industry. I just wish they could be honest. All I'm really after by writing this book is honesty. I'm just after ferreting out the way that these ideas come to us. History can be therapy too. And reading a book in which you understand how a doctor came to say to you, you have a biochemical imbalance and here's the drug for it, could be as therapeutic as exercise, as therapy, and as taking Prozac.
Gary Greenberg's book is called Manufacturing Depression, The Secret History of a Modern Disease. It's published by Simon & Schuster. Thank you so much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Thanks for listening to WNYC On Demand. Please check out the other programs at WNYC.org or on iTunes. This is a free service made available by our listeners. Become a member of WNYC today.